You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
All right, everyone, I'd like to welcome you back to the second panel after that fantastic first panel. Now we're going to be discussing a new ruling bargain, reform and Gulf elite dynamics. The three panelists, you have their identities on the schedule, and we're going to go in order as on the schedule. First speaker will be Andrew Hammond, who has a long time journalist for Reuters and author of a wonderful book about Saudi Arabia. Then we'll hear from Ali Al-Shahabi, who is a recently retired businessman from Saudi Arabia and who, I believe, also spends time in Dubai. And then we'll hear from Abdul Hadi Al Khalaf, a Bahraini political activist and senior lecturer in the sociology department at Lund University in Sweden. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. this is on? Well, I'll say a few things that probably, we've heard a little bit already, and I'll talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia because I've spent quite a bit of time there. I think the subject of the forum is the dynamism in the Gulf, and I think we have seen that these arguments sort of been around for a long time, in which the regimes themselves have had a lot of interest in promoting about essential values, essentially borrowing from Orientalist ideas of essentialist depictions of the Arabs. An unchanging region, political structures that are static, and the people being happy with this. I think it's become very clear in the last 2 years that this is all really essentially not true, and it's a regime-promoted idea. It borrows, as I think, from Orientalist depictions of the region. And it served, obviously, governments around the world and in the West well for a long time. It's an idea of exceptionalism that I don't think is correct. And it's been very clear in Saudi Arabia that the way the government itself has had to behave shows that they themselves realize that these arguments have never been correct. The religious scholars, the ulama, were required to remind Saudis that protesting was un-Islamic because Saudis wanted to protest, and they feared that they wanted to protest. The government was required to promise those huge increases in spending for key constituents in the country in order to keep people off the streets and to keep these constituents happy. Various constituents in the country clearly have grievances, as we've heard, including the Shiites in the eastern province, Ismailis in Najran, who we haven't mentioned yet, the detainees in Riyadh and north of Riyadh, rights activists, Islamist politicians who've been jailed for a couple of years now, and religious scholars of people like Salman al-Auda, who have been referred to before as the Sahwa clerics, who are of a more Muslim Brotherhood style, let's say, in their approach to politics and the nature of the relationship between clerics and the authorities. I think, too, we've seen Salafism itself shift and change before our eyes in the last 2 years, partly because of Saudi Arabia's encouragement, ironically, in the way they've encouraged Salafi movements in Egypt and Tunisia. Obviously, you had Salafis who were involved in politics in Kuwait and Bahrain previously, but still there were limits to the way they behaved and even the way they conceive of what their role is, even if they take part in elections. They don't see themselves in Bahrain, for example, they don't see themselves as ever forming a government or necessarily having much of a role in government. They like the idea of the parliament as being an advisory body, and that's enough. So there are clear reasons to question this alleged unshakability of the Saudi system. And, obviously, never say never. We've all seen where that got to before. Who predicted Iran in 79 or even Tunisia and Egypt before 2011? There were many reasons we can talk about now why they happened, but people didn't essentially see that coming. In Saudi history itself, there is actually plenty in recent Saudi history to show that the situation now is temporary. In the 1950s and 60s, it was a very different environment politically. In the 1970s, it was different socially. The essential change there was 1979. And when you had the seizure of the mosque in Mecca, you had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the Iranian Revolution. These three events scared the Saudi royal family and pushed them towards empowering the clerics further. When they talk about reform, as they have done in the last 10 years, they're essentially talking about rolling back 1979. They're not talking about rolling back to 1964, which is when the political system that is in Saudi Arabia, which is one that's static and doesn't change, and we think of as the permanent situation of Saudi society, that's when that began with the coup against Saud and led by Faisal and the brothers. Before that, it was a rather different situation. So Saudi Arabia has not been, as we've seen it for the last 30 years, last generation, it's not been that way socially or even politically in the past. It was something that came in time and will not necessarily last. Then after that, within those 30 years, you had, with the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq in 1990, you had the emergence of this movement of clerics, referred to as the Sahwa quite often, who were very clearly hassling for democratic changes. One of them was Salman al-Ouda, who has become prominent again today. Al-Ouda is interesting. He's not Brotherhood in any concrete sense, but he certainly falls within that bracket in the sense that he imagines a system where there's a popular role in government. He's not content with Al Saud dominating decisions, including foreign policy and the institutions of state. And he was one of the of those who there were three petitions that came after the beginning of the uprisings in 2011. There were three petitions at that time in Saudi Arabia. And he was a signatory to one of them, which called clearly for, and I quote, elected shura with, or elected parliament with absolute authority to pass laws and monitor the executive. Other clerics in this mold include Awad al-Gurney, who was on a Jazeera just 2 weeks ago, where he also, in not so many words, said that the system of government in Saudi Arabia is one he's not happy with, and he didn't even consider it particularly Islamic. I think if he were not in prison, someone like Saud Mukhtar al-Hashimi, who was jailed 2 years ago, would fall within the same bracket, in the sense of being an Islamist politician who would have the same demands. Now, I want to make this distinction between lay figures and clerical figures who fall within a kind of brotherhood approach to things because they imagine a political role for a role in politics for the country in an Islamist sense. The Brotherhood is essentially a movement of laymen. It's not a movement of clerics. And in Saudi Arabia, what is unusual is that you actually have so many clerics who have been active politically. Those who are Islamist politicians, let's say, they have the same demands and they would frame things in an Islamist manner. They're not clerics. They don't have access to the direct access to the body of the classical sources of Islam in the way that the clerics do. And I think you actually have a tension within the Brotherhood historically between and modern political Islamist movements. Between clerics and Islamist politicians. Islamists are of a different ilk. There is a very post-colonial movement, whereas clerics have been there from before that time. And in Saudi Arabia, they think of themselves, Wahhabism obviously doesn't consider itself in any way at all as a post-colonial movement. But what you have in Saudi Arabia is this unusual phenomenon of clerics like Al-Ouda, who are associated somehow or other with the Brotherhood movement, who are very prominent. And it wasn't a surprise to me to hear once Abdullah al-Hamid saying that he had heard that in Al Saud salons, they were describing the pro-democracy movement, this was in 2007, as a call for a Khomeini-style state. Because from their perspective, that's what it amounts to, because democracy for them, and their argument is, I think, to the outside world, democracy in Saudi Arabia means empowering the clerics even more in a political system where they would go into a parliament and then potentially they could form a government. That would be rather different in Saudi Arabia compared to Tunisia and Egypt, because you just don't have clerical figures who aspire to those roles or have those leadership roles within within movements like the Muslim Brotherhood. The other thing, I think, with people like Al-Auda, and this might be ironic in a way because you hear so many kind of crazy statements that come from many religious scholars in Saudi Arabia, and which appear in the media quite often. But I think people like Al-Auda and others, like and Awad al-Gharni and others, they're actually quite politically savvy in a way that Sunni scholars are not elsewhere. A good example being Yusuf al-Qaradawi in Qatar. I mean, just recently, Qaradawi responding to Nasrallah and Hezbollah's blatant involvement in Syria, he had this sermon where he called on Sunni Muslims to come to the aid of their brethren in Syria, said that Sunnis were being attacked and Hezbollah was pushing a specifically Shiite agenda to save al-Assad. Then he was on Al Jazeera the other day where he talked about a zealous sectarian partisanship. You know, Shias were piling into Syria specifically to kill Sunnis. And he kind of depicted some kind of demonic access of deviance, you know, because you had Alawis, who he attacked as being deviant Muslims, and then you have Assad, who he said isn't even believing anyway, and you have Iran and Hezbollah Shiite forces. You wouldn't really get this kind of language, neither from Nasrallah or from Al-Auda. And I think that reflects the fact that within Sunni political Islam, the Islamists, the lay politicians, are the ones who deal with politics and are expected to lead, and the clerics have a separate kind of role. But in Saudi Arabia, I think it's interesting, again, that you have someone like Al-Auda, who is much smarter than that, and he has the smartness you would have from someone like Nasrallah when it comes to this kind of political rhetoric. And, of course, in Shiism, it's different, because Nasrallah, he's a religious scholar and he's a politician. So it's odd that in a kind of walayat al-faqih kind of way, you have these two things coming together in Saudi Arabia, the religious scholar and the politician. At the same time, it's kind of interesting to note that in Bahrain, there's with Wafaq, the Shiite opposition party, which is the strongest party in the country, there's a certain pressure on them to downplay the religious leadership that they have. They're promoting Khalil al-Marzouk more than Ali Salman over the last year or so. Ali Salman was on BBC in an interview recently wearing a suit. You know, there's a kind of different direction going there, where there's a desire to deflate government rhetoric by playing down the religious credentials of those who lead the party. Looking beyond Saudi Arabia to the Gulf generally, you know, over the last two, three years, people are using, I mean, what phrases are relevant? People have talked of fall of regime, they've talked of democracy and participation. They're not all necessarily the same. And it's interesting, of course, I mean, within the Gulf, the fall of the regime, the phrase that started things in Tunisia and went to Egypt and went elsewhere, it's never been central, the central phrase in the movements that we've seen in the Gulf in the last 3 years. And I heard the opinion a couple of weeks ago from a former official from the American government in Qatar, who was saying that in Bahrain, where it first started in the Gulf, it was rather modest demands. And this could have been seen as a chance by the rest of the Gulf for, if they realized that there has to be change and that things cannot go on as they are in the political setups, you actually have a good chance there or something to deal with, because the people who are asking for something, for some kind of change, are not making radical demands. So that's something you can deal with. However, what we've seen is entirely the opposite, which leads to the main title, I would say, of what's going on right now, which is that the elites throughout the Gulf are not interested in a change in any meaningful manner whatsoever, and they're hunkering down to prevent anything. In Bahrain, the dialogues have gone nowhere. The security crackdown continues. The report of Bastuni, which was meant to lead to, for a start, less torture and abuse, even on that score, it's become clear that there's a lot still going on. And the government has cracked down on social media and crimes of social media in a heavy manner. In Kuwait as well, as we know, we've seen what happened there. In the Emirates, the trial of the 94 Islamists and other things that closed down a couple of organizations. And in Oman as well, there's been dozens who've been put on trial. As I heard recently, they've brought in quite a lot more. The expat population has risen in Oman considerably in the last 2 years. In what looks like it was an effort to stave off the labor unions and Omanis within the labor unions being a force for change or being able to organize protest and pursue collective bargaining in particular. In Qatar, there were elections which had been promised for this year, but it looks like they're not going to happen at all. And in a speech last month, the emir hinted actually at, he brought up the cultural specificity argument, suggesting that despite everything, there were different rules for Qatar or the rest of the Gulf. A popular poet was jailed. The case of the poet's interesting because he was young, he was using YouTube, he had a direct, he was using colloquial poetry, so he had direct access to youth. At the same time, he had demands by a group of intellectuals which were very direct, but which were ignored because they didn't have that kind of appeal to people in a direct manner. Just on a bit more on Qatar before I finish. I think essentially Qatar and Saudi Arabia have used, I would see the way they've been involved in Libya and Syria as a way of taking control of this disturbing movement called the Arab Spring and leading it in another direction. In a sense, it's a kind of counter-revolutionary process. But this has led to this very big breach in the Gulf now between Qatar and the rest of the Gulf countries because of Qatar's backing for the Muslim Brotherhood. At the same time, Saudi Arabia, like I was saying earlier, has been promoting Salafism as much as it can in various areas. Basically, I think, yes, the Gulf has proven its dynamic, but the leaders are doing all they can to obviate any need for meaningful change. In Saudi Arabia specifically, I think there could be more public protests and more coordination between disparate groups, which, as was said earlier, they definitely want to stop happening, but I think that's the way forward, what we might see happening. And within the royal family, I think there will be more infighting between the key princes. And as Mohammed bin Nayef tries to push back against the king's attempts to promote Mitab specifically. Yeah, that's basically it.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. Covered an enormous amount of ground. That was great. Ali.
Yes, just a quick introduction. My name's Ali Shahabi. I'm a product of a Saudi father and a Norwegian mother. I took early retirement from investment banking in the Kingdom and the Gulf to write a book called Arabian War Games, which is political fiction about future conflict in the region. So I'm enjoying a moment of zen in my life where I could become a talking head, which is a lot of fun, by the way. I really want to, I want to be unfashionable today, and I know I'll be among a minority in a setting promoted by the Program for Middle East Democracy here, with all due respect. But I think I would disagree with Andrew that elites are not interested in change. I think the issue is with how we define change. And the issue is with this obsession among Western elites and analysts on political activism, on democracy, and sort of on defining change in the way that looks palatable to analysts sitting in Washington or London. I think also looking at political activism is a bit like searching for your keys on a dark street under the streetlight. Because if you look at the extent of political activism in the region, particularly in Saudi Arabia, and I think my thesis is that the future of the Gulf will be written in Riyadh, not even in Saudi Arabia. Saudi holds the Gulf together. It legitimizes the regimes in the Gulf. Had the Al Saud been pushed out by Abdel Nasser in the 60s, none of the Gulf regimes would survive, would be around today. Had Islamism taken over Saudi Arabia in the 90s, the Gulf regimes wouldn't have been able to survive. So I think the future of the Gulf will be written in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh particularly, in the central region, in the heartland of Najd. And the question is, how relevant is political activism? I'll tell you something. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of noise, and rightly so, people are expressing their opinions. But the famous Day of Rage 2 years ago, when as part of the Arab Spring, when people expected the crowds to come out, hardly anybody came out. One person came out. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating, but he got a lot of coverage on BBC. And people said, well, there was this heavy police presence. There was a heavy police presence, but the Saudi police is not the Republican Guard in Iraq or Syria. It's really much more benign. And we saw subsequent to that, that even in an environment which is heavily policed like Syria, the crowds came out. So I don't think analysts have been able to answer that question. You know, well, the Saudis should be revolting. They should be coming out on the streets. Why aren't they coming out on the streets? Nobody's been able to answer that. So I think people look at the parameter of you know, democracy, participation, the role of women, all the things that are legitimate to look at, but then cannot understand why the people have not erupted. And I think it's because maybe people have a certain amount of common sense. They do, as Kristen said before, they do have something to preserve. And that preserving, and that they are reluctant to put that at risk. Now, to say, as Andrew said, that elites are not interested in change is a bit unfair. I think intelligent elites understand that change has to take place. I think there's a certain amount of concern and confusion about how that can happen, and will it go out of control or not? You know, if people in the region have read de Tocqueville. They know that the moment of maximum danger for a government is when it starts to reform. So, and obviously there are different opinions about that. And the barometer is not a Western intellectual liberal barometer. There are people who, you know, may not agree with the guidelines that you want to set for them. Remember again that many of the people that the so-called activists that you interface with as Western analysts and journalists, etc., are a small minority. The Westernized, sophisticated intellectuals really do not represent the more conservative mass of people in Saudi Arabia. So my argument today is really that I think one of the problems has been this unproductive focus on political participation and democracy rather than on more substantive points of reform that one could have gotten the governments to adopt, espouse, and be recognized for. So really, I think what I want to propose here is that the whole question of looking at reform in the Gulf and in Saudi Arabia maybe should be looked at slightly differently. I also want to insert a point of concern, which I think is a legitimate point of concern, which is that some of those who call for a rush to democracy and a rush to political participation in the kingdom and in the Gulf may not actually wish the Gulf well. I remember an article written by Anatole Levin, who was a member of Carnegie, I think, previously, in the early 1990s, which struck me as very interesting. He was writing that some people in Washington and in the West saw pushing for democracy as a way to break up the Soviet Union. And, you know, democracy did break up the Soviet Union. Now, that was very good for America. That was very good for the enemies of the Soviet Union. But was it good for the pensioner in Russia? Given what we know what happened post-breakup, it may be unfashionable to say, but was what happened ideal for Russia at that time? Anatole Levin also wrote that people were looking to try and use that against China, where pushing for democracy would lead also to a breakup of China. Well, the Chinese didn't play ball, and Tiananmen Square happened. And yes, it's very unfashionable. It was very unfortunate. It was tragic. But you know what? 20 years down the road, when you look at China, there's a strong argument to be made that maybe the small chaos of Tiananmen Square prevented a much larger chaos of a breakup of China, and that the economic growth that China has had over the last 20, 25 years has been worth it. So trying to hold the fort while going through the chaos of political change is very, very tricky. And we have recent experience in the Middle East, you know. I mean, experience has shown us that in Syria, Iraq, even Egypt, gradual reform would have been much better for the people of those countries, however unpalatable those regimes were, than revolutionary change. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, had Mubarak been wise enough to transition himself out, not put his son in, allow a bit more pluralism, Egypt would have been much better off than it is today. Obviously, Syria, I think, however criminal the regime is, if you go and poll the Syrians today, I think you'd get a solid majority wishing it didn't happen, because nothing is worth the price that the Syrians are paying today. So, you know, for those who argue that you need to break eggs to create an omelet, I would say that you haven't tasted the omelet that's being cooked in the post-revolutionary environment of the region today. So again, I come back to my argument. My thesis really is that we must focus on pushing for more realistic, modest, but achievable goals of improving governance. The focus should not be so much on democracy, activism, participation, but it should be on improving governance. The focus shouldn't be on really who's ruling the country, but on how they rule that country. And we should work towards creating an environment and incentives that prod rulers towards better governance and prioritize practical rather than utopian reform. I believe we should avoid the trap of focusing on the feel-good process of political participation, you know, prioritizing process over outcome, because that process becomes the holy grail, you know. Everybody talks about democracy, and if you're not in the democracy game, you're doing something wrong. So how do I define reform here? I think I define reform, you know, reform is a big word. Let me tell you how I don't define it. I don't define it as the right to vote at this stage. I define it as delivering tangible, practical improvements in government practice in areas of fundamental governance for a government. And these are things that sound boring, that elicit a yawn usually when you talk to analysts, but things like budgetary transparency, independence of the judiciary, and even a freer press. Now, why are these issues so critical? You know, something that always surprises me is that analysts talk about all sorts of criticisms of the region, but they never discuss budgetary transparency. If you go and poll people, the misallocation of resources, corruption, is a huge problem. It's something that offends and upsets a lot of people. Budgetary transparency can address that. And the more you encourage governments to make their budgets much more transparent, bringing it down to a micro level, the more you create natural checks and balances against waste, against inefficiency, against corruption, and hence for better governance. But these are sort of boring things, you know, they don't make careers, they don't make sexy articles, nobody focuses on them. You know, some people have spoken about the independence and transparency of the judiciary process. I think that's a very important first step before you get into political participation. Focus on the judiciary. Focus, you know, you might keep the legal system the same, nobody's going to change Sharia law in Saudi Arabia, but focus on making it more independent. And also focus on increasing the margin of press freedom. Again, give people, give these governments a bit of credit also for moving the line forward. Understand, for example, that in Saudi Arabia, you know, they have allowed more of a margin of press freedom. It's nothing like what you want, but you know, there are TV channels that come out of Dubai that are Saudi influenced that allow much more of a margin. YouTube, for example, some of the comedy work, brilliant comedy work that's being done by young Saudis, is actually very critical. I'm surprised when I watch it sometimes, and that is being allowed. You know, people on Twitter, like Ahmed Al-Omran, are also being allowed to come out. So the government realizes that, first of all, press freedom for them is something that they have to compete with social media. So they have to allow that space, and they have to get better at it, and they have to get better playing that game. And I think there is something to be said to changing the narrative and giving governments a certain amount of credit for progress in this area. And let me elaborate a bit more of how I think the international community, the United States, people like Carnegie, can help. You know, I think if instead of calling for democracy at every opportunity and leading governments to waste their energy on cosmetic attempts at elections and parliaments, you know, I mean, I think, for example, the ultimate cosmetic attempt at elections is what's happening in Iran today. In Iran, the supreme leader ultimately is the final voice on everything. But we have a big circus going on in Iran about a so-called election with the, and I, you know, you can give a Machiavellian award to the Iranians for the brilliance, because it seems to have sucked in so many analysts outside. Everybody's talking about the election and today's election, who's going to win, and so-and-so is a moderate, and so it's all the same thing, because ultimately the top guy runs the show. It's all cosmetics. Again, in the Gulf, by encouraging governments to, you know, have sham parliaments and have elections, and it's a waste of energy, and it's encouraging to set up a facade that is false. Rather, the U.S. and others could change the language to focus on meaningful reform. And for example, you could set up benchmarks. Yeah, you could come and say, you know, I'm going to benchmark budget transparency, and I'm going to put, you know, the U.S. and EU at the top at 10 and North Korea at 0, for example. And then you can start to benchmark the governments. And then you can give them credit as they move up, up the stage. Remember, these governments want to have acceptance. They realize they have an image problem. And also, many of them realize that they have to reform to survive. So I think there is a potential win-win in this environment, because also there are a lot of elements within these elites that want to push for reform. But when reform is packaged in achievable, practical, modest steps that can be achieved, you can hold people accountable. But when you come and tell them, here's a utopian structure, people want to forget what the West went through to reach democracy, you know. So I'm told I'm running out of time. So let me just say that a fundamental point here also that governments have to be careful of is maintaining the infrastructure of governance under all circumstances. And what is that infrastructure of governance? It's the monopoly on violence, and it's the capacity to deliver basic services. I think if you risk that, you risk state breakdown. And nothing is worth the destruction that we see today in Syria, in Libya, in Iraq, and even in Egypt, which has a much more developed political environment than Saudi Arabia does. So I would conclude by repeating that we should focus on governance, which is not very sexy, compared to words like freedom and democracy, liberté, égalité, you know, all those nice words that people like to talk about, but focus on a more boring process, which is accretive, but is achievable and potentially not destructive, like potential attempts at democracy can be. Thank you.
Thank you. Abdulhadi?
Thank you for inviting me here and joining this interesting discussion. I prepared something, and I feel I must change a few things in response to what we have heard today. But let me start with something that Anthony Korsman wrote some 5 years ago. He was discussing challenges facing the Gulf states, GCC countries. He counted 7 different challenges, starting from the conventional military threats, lack of mission in the GCC armed forces, asymmetric warfare, and he goes on until he reaches number 7, which is demography. The rest are only military, only security threats. He did not see that there were in the Gulf any other challenges except those dealing directly with Iraqi instability or emanating from energy infrastructure. Demography was added there because of foreign labor. Now, at the time, of course, that to be fair to Anthony Korsman, of course, this was not he was not alone in believing that the Gulf states were stable. They were resilient. They have seen wars. They have seen coup d'états. They have seen palace coups. They had seen revolts, rebellions, and small demonstrations here and there. And they continued to be stable, to continue as if nothing happened. But those of us who were studying the region, those social scientists or political scientists who were not obsessed with security and military sales, we have seen that at the time there were a number of problems in the Gulf, shared in the whole region. First of all, that the stability, the future of the Gulf, even in the mid 1980s, were defined by the demographic changes that were taking place in the region because of the excessive import of foreign labor, that excessive import as a response to the need of development following the oil boom of the 70s, but also as a result of social engineering's politics that ruling regimes in the Gulf, the ruling families in the Gulf have initiated after mid-1970s to bring willing workforce that can be disposed of any moment at the will of the security forces or the sheikh or the king. The demographic changes that were occurring in the Gulf resulted in what we have seen now. 50% of the population are foreigners. Foreigners without rights. They are deportable, disposable, and of course, without legal rights while they are staying in the region. The second problems that we have seen in mid-80s and were discussed was the rising expectations and demands by the elites. Elites were expressing their need to participate in politics, to participate in decision making, and in allocation of wealth. The increasing wealth that were accrued by the countries of the region. The third set of problems that we have seen are also the growth of the ruling families themselves. They were increasing in numbers. Their numbers are expanding, and their entitlement from the state treasury has increased. They were eating more of the state cake than what their fathers used to do. So, which leaves less of the cake to the rest of the population. The rising in numbers of the ruling families also was associated with rising of factions within the ruling families. Each of the ruling families started building alliances, depending on whose mothers they belong to, which tribe their mothers belong to, or their uncles belong to. And this we have seen, of course, the story of the stories that you have known about the Saudi ruling family, and then we have seen it in Bahrain. We have seen similar stories in Qatar, and of course, Awlad Fatima in Abu Dhabi. These factions are political, and they are real, and they represent social, economic, and security risk for the societies of the region. The fourth problem that we have also discussed was the incompetence of the ruling families. The ruling families were wasting wealth. They were corrupt. They were their ability to use the fantastic incomes that were accrued by the Gulf region since the oil boom started in early 70s on until now. They have They were incompetent and they wasted. They built armies that were unusable, armies that in 1991, everyone discovered they cannot even defend Khafji or the at the border of Kuwait. So this led to realization that we are exceptional in one sense. We are exceptionals that the Gulf region is tolerated because of external interests. The ruling families are maintained in their positions because they serve purposes. They serve international interests. They sell. They serve the armed merchants. They sell. They served the war mongers during the Cold War, and of course, all the corrupt economies around the world. Now, what was exceptional in the Gulf that Kurdistan and other analysts of the region did not see? The Gulf states are unique in this sense. They are authoritarian regimes, they are rich, and they are allied with the West. These are three features define why the Gulf has survived, the ruling families survived. It is not because their tribal background or because of people love them or because of they lack, there is no willingness from the elite. As Ali has rightly said, the elite won't change, but they cannot change because of the three pillars working together in a synergic form, frustrating every attempt for change. Look for the Parliament of in Bahrain of 1973, of which I was a member. Ended. The experiment ended within 2 years, and no one in the from the in the West. In Western administrations, in the governments in the West, protested against the against cancellation of one of the emerging democratic experiments in the region. That would have been a lesson for Riyadh to learn from, not vice versa. But Riyadh did not want, the rulers of Riyadh did not want to learn from a small country that was experimenting in democracy. I'm talking about 73. Of course, this will continue later. Saudi ruling family will intervene also in Kuwait and will frustrate other experiments, other attempts to reform elsewhere. Now, how did it do it? How these ruling families did what they do? What they did? They did it through working on society by fragmenting it, fragmenting our societies into corporations, dividing it into tribes, into sub-tribes, into ethnic groups, into sub-ethnic groups. In Bahrain or in eastern Saudi Arabia or in Qatar, you are not speaking now, we speak now of Shia and Sunni, but I, as a student of society there, I have written as much as I can about details of how the ruling families divide even villages, Shia villages or Sunni villages. The harshest security attack on any action, on any demonstration, on any petition, whatever, however peaceful it is, the harshest attack happens to those that are joint actions, joint by either several villages or Shia and Sunni or even gender-based. The ruling families in the Gulf just love fragmenting societies. and they fragment it they fragment it vertically so that there is no possibility to cooperation between vertical segments of the societies. And look into, this is a problem for elite cooperation within a country and within the whole region, that we elites cannot cooperate because these long-standing fragmentation. Now, how is this fragmentation? Is not the sheikh here or the emir there is not that clever, is not that genius, but it is simple. One of the simplest matter of when you are authoritarian, rich, and allied with the West, you have several techniques for doing that. One of them is, of course, put every protester in prison or push them into exile. That is one. The second one, of course, is cry for legitimacy from the West. Everyone who is against the regime is either a pro-Nasser in the 50s or pro-Soviet in the 60s, or pro-Khomeini in the 80s, and so on. The third one, which is more important, and this is what I am working on now, is the ability of the ruling families to use makrama, dividing, allocating oil wealth, oil revenues, managing it, who gets what from those revenues. Ruling families decide exactly where will they build a mosque or where will they build a school. It is not because they have studied society in such a manner, know what are the future development and what are the future needs. It is also to create competition between regions, villages, and elite groups. Elite groups are bought, co-opted, frightened, vilified, and of course, they are also encouraged to compete with each other. Elite groups are members of the elite cannot cooperate with each other because they are also competing for favors from the ruling family, and this ends up in what we have now. Golden bargain. We never had a golden bargain. We were in the Gulf. We never had a golden bargain. What we had was iron bargain that was forced on us. Thank you.
All right. I'd like to thank all three of the speakers, and I think it's wonderful that we have a broad range of opinions here and some, I think, core disagreements about the nature of the challenges facing these Gulf societies and the way that Gulf elites might be responding to them. I thought before going to the audience, it might be useful to try and put our speakers into dialogue with each other a little bit about those issues. And I think the most fundamental distinction here, of course, is the one, I think, between Ali and the other two speakers about the desirability of democratic reforms and the nature and quality of the current types of reforms being carried out by leaders and elites in the Gulf. And so I'm curious if Andrew and Abdulhadi would like to kind of respond directly to that, and then Ali could respond in turn to their rebuttals. And in particular, I'd like to think about this and have you think about this across the Gulf in terms of, are there some cases where you see this as working better than others? For example, if I look at Bahrain, I don't see any sign whatsoever that you're right about the regime being more forthcoming towards their own people. In fact, the last 2 years strikes me as going in very, very much the opposite direction. And if you look at Kuwait, you see a parliament demanding exactly what you ask for, scrutiny over government budgets, accountability of the ruling family to an elected parliament, and the response is the dissolution of the parliament and probably the most severe political crisis in the country's history. So maybe moving beyond Saudi Arabia, looking farther into the Gulf, what do you see happening there? Andrew, did you want to offer any thoughts?
Specifically on Saudi Arabia, I think, Ali mentioned corruption. I mean, over the years, there have been numerous occasions when the government has come forward and said that it's going to try and challenge corruption. And the fact that you have to come again 2 years ago or just after in 2011 and come out with the same suggests there's a problem. And I'm not sure how you can solve it when you say that not having the right to vote is a situation that we should have. How the system is meant to correct itself and monitor itself and has not proven to do that in the past, and now we're expecting it to do it now without there being some kind of fundamental change involving people who have the right to vote and a say in how their own country is run, I don't see how that works. I really don't. The other thing with Saudi Arabia is you say that they are the elite, or the government authorities, I assume we mean, are thinking of ways of change. Where are they? Because we really haven't seen anything when it comes to Saudi Arabia. What we have seen is a lot of maneuvering between those, the elite, who do actually have some kind of democratic process amongst them, which is the ruling family, with the council that the king set up, though it hasn't. There was already a family council anyway. So there's some kind of process of discussion amongst them, but not for everybody else. While they argue, while they maneuver, I don't really see anything happening. It is interesting, however, that one of the important princes, Al-Walid, has at least tried to cut an image of someone who's interested in the reforms, which would allow people to have a say in running their own country. Whether he is one of the princes that is in really has a serious chance of taking charge anytime in the future, I don't know. He's not normally seen that way. That's specifically on Saudi Arabia.
Can I just address Ansar's question?
Oh, sure.
I mean, look, it's easy to throw darts, and it's easy to criticize. And there are a lot of things that you have to criticize these governments for. I think, though, at the end of the day, you have to compare them to their peers. When I look, and again, I focus back on Saudi Arabia because I think the future of the Gulf, again, I repeat myself, will be written in Riyadh. I think Al Saud have delivered 100 years of stability for their people. When you in a part of the world where they owned a quarter of the world's oil reserves, they had the holy places, they could have easily gotten intoxicated with power like Gaddafi did or like Saddam did. Again, I cannot compare Saudi Arabia to Kuwait or to Qatar, which are city-states. So I think that when history judges them, they'll say, look, they delivered 100 years of stability for their people, which allowed their people to get educated, basic infrastructure to be built, a lot of basic things that have not happened in Iraq, that have not happened in Libya, because those governments were adventurous and did not know the limits of their power. So I think that when you put the balance sheet, you should not forget the positives. Corruption is a problem, absolutely. But you know what? And budgetary transparency will address it. But corruption is a problem in most countries in the world also. And nobody has found the perfect formula to address it. What are the lobbies in Washington if not corruption, when money can control many parts of the political process in the United States? Go to Africa, go to China. Corruption is a huge problem in many countries. So we're talking about progressive reform. Now, I think the priority at the end of the day in this dangerous time is to hold the state together. Now, state breakdown is a big risk, and we are seeing it. We are seeing it in Syria. We're seeing it in Iraq. We're seeing it across the whole region. At the end of the day, does the Saudi citizen want the right to vote, or does he want the right to run a risk of getting the chaos, which is a very high risk? So you can criticize these elites. It's never easy to give up power. It's never easy to give up privilege. I mean, history tells us that. But at the end of the day, they have delivered much more value than their peers have delivered. And I think that's a more fair way of looking at them.
Abdelhadi?
Well, I was brought up to, when I was young, we always called Saudi Arabian the big sister, I think. Saudi Arabia is a big sister, but big sisters can be over domineering.
Maybe positively. Now let me
add here that now look at Saudi Arabia. You have the stability you are talking about is marred by removal of King Saud by coup d'etat, palace coup d'etat, assassination of King Faisal by a royal family member, by the wars that Saudi Arabia has waged in Yemen and waged also in neighboring countries through proxy. This stability you are talking about is a stability based on buying influence in various countries in the world, starting from Italy in 1975, and we have records on that. Involvement, Saudi Arabia was involved in corrupting politicians even in Italy. And now we have seen. I come from Sweden now. The biggest crisis now in the local politics is Saudi scandal. Saudi now import 30% of Swedish arms export, and because of this 30%, they have clout on politics in Sweden. And now we have really crisis. The parliament cannot do much about it because of labor force conditions. Stability is at high cost. Now you said everyone is. Want to have cohesion in the country, to have a country united. Did anyone ask the people in Qatif or Hijaz, do you want Al Saud to continue dominate you? These Al Saud do not even mention that they are by popular will. You do that. Saudi rulers, they say, we have taken it by the sword. And this is it.
Yes.
This is it. And they see it as a loot of war. The whole country is a loot of war. And this is not something that we in the 21st century could tolerate.
Well, I mean, look, stability. You mentioned actually examples that, I mean, the removing King Saud was a painless. There was no bloodshed. It was a coup that happened. It was a brother being pushed out for incompetence by the other brothers. I think that is a reflection of stability rather than lack of stability. King Faisal was shot by a deranged nephew. Again, it had no impact. No blood was shed. The structure of government did not get affected. Transition was immediate. So actually, that proves the point of stability. Now, look, we are talking about relativity here. We're not. You can describe 100 things that are wrong with the government. The point is, in a region that has always been at a high risk of state breakdown, has an environment been created where people have been able to enjoy a substantial amount of wealth? Yes, have the elites enjoyed more? They absolutely have gotten more of a share. But at the end of the day, Saudi has 100,000 students in America, yahi. It's not a joke, you see. It has hundreds of thousands in university. Is the educational system perfect? No, it's not. But you know what? It's better than it was 50 years ago. The first PhD in Saudi Arabia came in 1959. So that you have to remember, when you look at a country, for example, like Algeria, when I always compare Algeria, because Algeria got its independence in 1960, it was part of France. It inherited, you know, a whole infrastructure of governance. Saudi Arabia started from zero. Now, did they take it by the sword? Sure. I mean, the American Republic was put together with the sword. What General Sherman did in the South, my friend, was much worse than Ibn Saud did in Hijaz. But at the end of the day, many countries are put together by the sword. Look at China today. Again, China is not a democracy. Are people being asked in China? No, they're not. So the point is, ultimately, you have to go back from your intellectual distaste, which many people have for inherited wealth and privilege, particularly excessive wealth, and look and say, what is the interest in the interest of the basic person? Yes, he doesn't have freedom. He doesn't have the capacity to you know, exercise the privilege that an American has. Yes, but at the end of the day, he is in a developing country that has not had the hundreds of years since the Magna Carta that Anglo-Saxon civilization has had. So you have to measure Al Saud to their peers and not to the King of Sweden. You know, I'm sure you appreciate the King of Sweden. You live in Sweden.
No,
but
no,
at the end of the day...
I am in the Republican Party.
You're in the Republican Party?
All right. So basically no new ruling bargain because the old one's just fine.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. That's a misrepresentation of what I'm saying. I'm saying is that the ruling bargain has to change gradually. A gradual reform is the best possible option. And when I mean gradual reform, I mean decades, not centuries. America and the West had centuries to go through coming up with their final bargain. I think the region needs decades, and it needs help by avoiding prioritizing the emotionally satisfying political participation democracy headline and focusing on more substantive things that make a difference and that elites can buy into, and then over time restructure the bargain.
Okay, let's go to our very enthusiastic audience. Mervet? Wait for the...
Have you been?
Mervet Hatem, Howard University. I think I want to answer the question about a new ruling bargain by saying that basically the new ruling bargain seems to be more of the same. And more of the same, I'm struck by the fact that obviously immediately after the spread of the Arab Spring, the Saudi government and the Kuwaiti government as well went ahead with a huge package, a huge economic package, basically to buy off the subservience of their own populations. The only thing that may not necessarily work by doing more of the same is the fact that political Islam now, as a result of the Arab Spring, is associated with democracy, because basically the Arab uprising has allowed governments, Islamist governments, not just in Tunisia and in Egypt, but Islamist governments that actually defend democracy as a political system that is compatible with Islam. And that in itself is a major challenge of one of the principles of the ruling bargain in the Arabian Gulf, which is basically government in the name of Islam.
Okay. Why don't we go straight back?
Sarah Chase, Carnegie. A question for Mr. Shehabi and one for Mr. Khalaf. I don't like to do that normally, but I'm actually somewhat sympathetic with your notion of focusing on accountability and transparency of government functions. The question I would raise is, are you sure that those are actually more achievable reforms than democratic reforms? And this touches on something that Mr. Hammond suggested in the case of Kuwait, that I found in a number of different countries that once you start really drilling down on serious accountability issues, you get hammered a lot worse than you do when you look for the right to vote or something like that, which can be deflected in ways that you suggested. That was one. The second for Mr. Khalaf, I'm very interested in the point you raised about the 50%, the demographics, and 50% of at least of the populations of a number of Gulf countries are not nationals. And in some European countries that used to import labor up till the 1970s, there came a point when they could no longer have people in their countries that had zero rights. So either they received a certain degree of rights because they were, given the equivalent of green cards, or they were nationalized. And that then led to a demand for less discrimination and things like that. And I wonder how you see that evolution potentially playing out in the Gulf. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. And we'll take one more here.
Rahman Jabouri, National Endowment for Democracy. I want to have a big faith in Ali, and I will ask this question, follow on Sarah. Do you see any constitutional monarchy in Saudi in 20 years so we can believe in this room, there is change is coming. So we can hold people accountable, people get elected, not the same person giving orders. That's one. Second, would you guys also shed some light on United Arab Emirates? There is a political movement. There is a Ikhwan Muslimin there. And in Oman, where the labor movement is strong too. It's not all about Saudi. If there is a change, again, for Ali, the change will come from outside Saudi Arabia, not from within Saudi Arabia. Thanks.
Thank you. Addressing the question of transparency first. You see, transparency of budgetary transparency is a gradual process. So it's not going to go from opaqueness now to total transparency tomorrow. They will start, and when they start, a message starts to go through the bureaucracy, and people start to be more careful about how they allocate funds. I do think it's much easier, because by opening up political participation, I mean, look at Kuwait. Well, you know, I look at Kuwait, and I think that the Kuwaitis, democracy for them has been a luxury. It's entertainment, because Kuwait really is deadlocked and has been deadlocked. So if Kuwait didn't have the wealth that it has to be able to afford the luxury of democracy, as it calls it, which leads it to continuous deadlock, it wouldn't move forward. So I think that, yes, elites don't like to give up power, and yes, this may sound like an excuse, but premature democracy has been proven time and time again to lead to...
That wasn't my question. My question was, do you really think that these governments will actually accept fundamental changes in transparency?
I think if the headline is changed, now they are being vilified, and they're aware of it. They're being vilified globally, and particularly in America, which is important for them, and with public opinion, that they're not democratic. And the whole issue is, are you a Democrat or are you not a Democrat? Which is why Erdogan gets, I mean, the amount of, you know, demonstrations in Turkey is a thousand times what has ever happened in Saudi Arabia. But because he's a Democrat, he's elected, it's a different story. Had that happened in Riyadh, the whole world would have been up and rising. So I think if you change that headline and they start to feel that budgetary transparency is a factor by which the world will start to judge them differently, i.e. good governance, I think so, yes.
So the Al-Saud family would accept some kind of external or public oversight over their spending?
It's not a question of that. It's as they allow the budget to get more transparent, they become self-regulating because you have the media, you have the world, you have people benchmarking them. So it's not a question of them allowing a committee to come and tell them how to spend. They are going to be bound by the transparency that comes out of it.
What would be a first step that would make you think that this is actually happening?
Well, I mean, you can, as I said, you benchmark the budget today. It would be an exercise for Carnegie to do. You go and say the U.S. budget is at 10, North Korea is at 0, Saudi is at 6. And then you see, you know, how much more transparent because certain lines are transparent. And if the year after that you get a higher level of transparency, they move up to 7. If it doesn't, they go down to 4. It is quite an easy thing to measure and to create a certain amount of public pressure on. And it's productive.
Yes, may I jump to answer your question, the question you put to Ali first? Last week, Gulf Center for Development Studies published a report. Interesting report. I recommend that you look into it. It is available in Arabic and executive summary in English. The transparency is not going to come. The report suggested this from the comparing the amount of value of export of oil and gas between 2002 and 2011. And the number of money that were put into the treasuries of the Gulf state, the report says $750 billion missing. We are talking about $7.5 billion per year. I don't think if I have that much in my pocket, I will be transparent. And I will pay at least half of it to cover. To buy support, etc., to buy lawyers and media fellow to sell me. No, the question is a dilemma for the Gulf. In 75, the demographic dilemma. In 75, the number of foreigners in the region were 22%. Now it is 50 plus. I mean, depending on how illegals are. The number of, at the time, 75, we are talking about, that is a threshold, the breaking, when they discovered, the royal families discovered that now we don't need to bring Arabs or to bring those who can claim political rights. We bring people from as far away, culturally, linguistically, and even ethnically, from far away, from Thailand, from subcontinental India, etc. So the number in the labor force from risen from locals from fell from 61 in 75 to 31 now, one third, from two thirds to. So the ruling families are happy with this situation, but ILO started, and the World Bank, there was a movement. They started, and of course, with a contribution from a number of human rights activists and international NGOs like Human Rights Watch, and pressure on the plight of these foreigners, their rightlessness. And there, of course, misery, the miserable, today, in the morning, today, in Bahrain newspaper, for suicides among them. And suicides are daily reported in the local press. These people will have to have their rights. When the press, local press, always bring up the example of Fiji. Look, there, Indians are in control. So this is exactly what the ruling families is frightening me, the Arab, the local, the Shia, the Sunni. Ah, now the Indians will take, so let us not have the voting rights for you. Let us have it as it is. We are happy.
Andrew?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's there's an irony that the more foreigners that are brought in, then the more this becomes an argument, a cunning argument to say, well, let's not change the system and start talking about voting rights and participation, because that's going to open the way to all the foreigners in the country to start thinking about these things, especially those amongst them who've been there for a long time, and that we will find international organizations will more and more start to pick up on these issues and talk about them. As I kind of hinted at earlier, I think since 2011, these tendencies are actually getting worse to rely on the foreigner, because it's another way of obviating having any serious change, and which is ironic because you do have serious efforts going on in the Emirates anyway. There's a serious effort to try and work out how they can fix their economy and its reliance upon foreigners, and to try and get Emiratis in work. And I think generally the kind of image that is being put forward by some of the governments is that there's some kind of third way that's not democratic, it's not an absolutist system, there's some kind of third way. I think in Saudi Arabia, I think it's less convincing that that's possible in a country of its size, of its diversity, with the traditions that it has, and the traditions of civic participation that you have. They didn't start from zero in Saudi Arabia. Al Saud took them to zero. You know, in Hijaz, they had an Ottoman court system in the Hijaz that is like the system. They're trying to reform the Saudi judiciary now to take it back to where it was in the Hijaz that Al Saud destroyed when they took over the Hijaz. So Al Saud took the place to zero. You know, in this country, I don't think it's possible really to push this idea of a third way. I think maybe in the Emirates it's more possible because you have the system is split between seven distinct entities, and there's a lot of wealth around, and it's slightly different. Potentially, the Emirates will outlast these pressures more than the others, is my suspicion. But I think that, again, the idea of change coming from Riyadh, I don't think anymore. I think that's over. I think Saudi Arabia is in real trouble. I think the changes are going to come from Kuwait and Bahrain. I think the system in Kuwait it's been a kind of soap opera for everyone in the Gulf, and, you know, and governments and people around them are able to laugh and say, oh, look at Kuwait, isn't it a joke? This is democracy that they're talking about, you know, people are talking about. The Kuwaiti system was set up with a tension between the ruling family and the elected parliament. So that the family chooses the cabinet, the government, and the parliament has a control over, can pass legislation. That's a system that is there to create problems, and that's why the problems are there now. So it's hardly an ideal model anyway, even though it's the best one within the Gulf, but it's not ideal anyway, and in itself, it is trying to change, as we see. And there's more chance, I think, of the change happening in Kuwait than anywhere else in the Gulf, and that is going to be the big change in the Gulf as well. It's not coming from Riyadh.
Let's take another round of questions. Why don't we go farther to the back now?
Hi, my name is Matar Ibrahim, a former MP from Bahrain. And in fact, I was...
Louder, please.
Matar Ibrahim, former member of the parliament in Bahrain. During the uprising, I was detained. And in fact, during my detention, the interrogator was asking me about a single call. They were monitoring all my calls. That call was with the human rights activist Nabil Rajab. We were discussing how to address the wealth of the ruling family in Bahrain. My question to Ali, do you think if I'm in Saudi Arabia, I will get different kind of questions if I'm there? Another question is, do you really think that United States and the Western country in general are troubling Saudis by calling for democracy? So
are troubling?
Do they making a lot of trouble and disturbance for Saudis for calling for democracy in the Gulf? And does it really? Do you feel that such kind of events here have kind of reflection on the foreign policy of United States of America and the Western country when it comes to the region of the Gulf? Thanks.
No, look.
Okay. Wait, let's take a few more questions. In the back there. Right there.
I forget the question, buddy.
Hi, my name is Rachel Peterson, Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. I want to add on to what Matar said, and let's just assume that, Ali, what you're saying is accurate and that that if we stop asking for democracy, that things are going to get better, which I highly doubt. However, what should we be asking for instead? You know, you said budget transparency and that if Carnegie produces a report that says how Saudi Arabia's budget transparency is and then releases another one next year with a lower grade that'll change things, I don't see that happening. The U.S. government releases reports frequently about human rights violations or violations of freedom of the press, and they criticize governments, and most governments just brush them off. So how would a report like that make any difference?
Look,
let's try and get, we have about 20 people who want to ask questions. Let's try and get a few of them in really quickly. Right back there.
Hi, I'm Jen Heeg, and I'm currently a fellow at USAID.
I have to remind you what the questions are, by the way.
Okay.
Thank you for this great discussion. So my impressions come mostly from spending 5 years in Qatar, so I'm sorry if this is Qatar-specific, but I think it is relevant to everybody. And it is about this question on democracy. I published a piece a few years ago about why that may be a misguided focus, because simply the majority of the people who live in the Gulf are migrants. And I'm so happy that we're actually having that conversation here. It's often that I come to conversations about the Gulf, and that's not mentioned at all. So if it were a perfectly functioning democracy in Qatar or the UAE, that would be 10% of the population, and they're really the elite 10% who are the citizens who would be voting. So it is an important consideration, I think. And also to mention that if there were a democratic movement in some of these countries, it may not be in the U.S. interest. In Qatar, for example, there's a lot of resentment against the emir, who people see is probably a little bit too pro-U.S., and that's obviously caused problems for him in the region as well. So there are geostrategic concerns that we should take into account. And then also to mention that we talk a lot about the political systems and democracy, but I think we're taking a very Western perspective when we talk about what is governance in the Gulf. Because the reality is, in countries with the sponsorship system, governance is privatized on a daily basis. Where you can go, if you can go into a shopping mall, that is determined by the owners of the shopping mall. If you can leave the country, That's determined by your sponsor. What your wages are, where you eat, where you live, all of those things are controlled in the private sector. And the government really has a much more constrained set of powers. And I think that there's, you know, in some of these countries, even the government rules at the pleasure of the business sector. And so I think it's something that we should take into account, that this idea of democracy maybe would affect a much more constrained set of circumstances.
Okay, thank you. Ali.
I mean, first of all, I'm not just talking about budgetary transparency. I'm talking about better governance. And I'm saying, rather than focusing on political participation and democracy today, which frankly is unimplementable in the current situation, in the current environment. If you go back even to Egypt, you know, Egypt had a constitution at the turn of the century, a women's movement at the turn of the century. It had pluralism, it had a free press, and look at the struggle that it's having. Now, so the kingdom needs time. It needs to be encouraged to reform. Obviously, if it doesn't reform, it will be a problem. But it needs to be encouraged to reform in practical steps. Will the government like it? Maybe not, but many elements of the elite and of the royal family understand that the system has to be reformed, that they understand that to survive. And yes, in 20 years from time, it may not be a constitutional monarchy, but it may be more like a Juan Carlos-type monarchy in the early days of Spain, where you have a check and balance. So I think that the elites are nervous because they see that, obviously, nobody wants to give up power. And they see that if you let loose the forces of pluralism and democracy without a proper foundation, you run the risk of state breakdown. So they are circling their wagons. You know, the Chinese realize that. I mean, what did the Chinese do in Tiananmen Square? They killed thousands, you know, and the whole world. I mean, I'm sure Carnegie was up, you know, and all the project for democracy. Everybody was outraged with the Chinese. But at the end of the day, I think you can argue that they did the right thing, however horrible it was, because had China broken down, you would have had many more thousands, and you would have had much more suffering. So, it's difficult to attack things like freedom and democracy and liberty. They're lovely things. We all want to have them. But I think that certain levels of development, people again forget the hundreds and hundreds of years, the wars, the turmoil that the West went through to reach where they are today.
But Ali, can we go back to Matar's specific question, and also I think Sarah's, which is, should critics be allowed to openly discuss and criticize royal family expenditures today? If they're not asking to vote.
Look, it's happening today. It's happening on Twitter today. People should look at Twitter. It's happening on Twitter. People are commenting.
Your argument is that should be protected and encouraged because...
Well, it's not a question of being protected and encouraged. It's a reality. Nobody likes it. You know, you wouldn't like to be criticized, Mark. If I came and found out things wrong with you and I criticized it and you could stop it, you'd like that. We're human. We don't like to be criticized. But it's a reality. They realize it. They realize they have to live with it. Social media has created the reality. And as a result, it's slowly adapting, but they realize that they do not have a monopoly on information anymore. Now, the point is that budgetary transparency starts to send the message, if it's done well, and people start to take it into account.
Do either of you want to, or should we go back to the floor?
Well, there was one question about whether, I think it was Mutter who asked whether the United States as a government was seen as serious in trying to promote some kind of reform agenda or something. I really don't think it is seen as serious within the Gulf, and especially when it comes to Saudi Arabia. I mean, we mentioned already earlier Kerry's visit. He had nothing to say about some of the issues that were going on in Saudi Arabia. I don't think there's a perception at all that American policymakers have got to that point where they've decided that it's time to really push for a new kind of Saudi Arabia.
If I may just interject here, because I forgot to answer that question. Sure. Look, Saudi Arabia started municipal elections. Why did they do that? Because of all the pressure. And municipal elections were a waste of time and effort and were cosmetic. So it is a waste of time. It is a waste of effort. All these parliaments that are being set up, you know, rather than devoting that message to substantive reform, you are encouraging people to go down the cosmetic route. And if what America said had no impact, they wouldn't have done these. You wouldn't have parliaments all over the Middle East that are cosmetic.
Andrew, do you want to...
I think that potentially there could be a change in the relation between the American government and and the Gulf and Saudi Arabia because of the situation with oil, Saudi Arabia's ability to control, to influence prices with OPEC and production is much less, and that will continue. The shale oil revolution will affect things as well, and the Iraqi oil on the market too. Saudi Arabia's position for United States is changing. Its importance is changing. It's not like it has been in previous decades, and that could really change things too.
I think that'll be a big topic of the final panel. Okay, I'm going to take another round of questions, but only raise your hand if you can credibly commit to using only two sentences and having a question mark at the end. Any hands want to go down? Okay, sir, right here.
Mahfouz Tadros, World Bank retiree. I agree with Ali's gradual approach in general. However, we should not limit that gradual approach to political reform. It has to include economic reform and education reform. Diversifying the economies in the Gulf countries is a major challenge that very few Gulf countries have addressed and they should address. Maybe we will be addressing the economic reform and the education reform next session. But the other question I have is about the foreign labor or the non-Gulfies who are living there. Mm-hmm. Are the Gulf countries scared from these foreigners? And if so, how? Thank you.
Scared. Thank you. Scared. How about right here?
Greg Aftandilian with the Center for National Policy. This relates to the previous panel, but it connects to this one, is the issue of youth unemployment. Mm-hmm. Among the nationals, not talking about the foreign workers, the nationals of these countries, recent studies have shown that youth unemployment has actually grown over the past decade. Is the inability of these governments, either through the public sector or private sector, to employ these people, is that going to be the tipping point? Because one of the causes, there were many causes of the Egyptian revolution, was the fact that you had hundreds of thousands of young people coming out of the universities with really no prospect of a decent living. Thank you.
Okay, here in the front row.
Oh, hi, I'm Will Beckham from Project on Middle East Democracy. I just had a quick question. The woman from ADRHB talked about the lack of utility when it came to statements from the U.S. government in terms of creating this credible change. And for countries like the U.S. to support these democratic or reform movements in the Gulf, what assets of state power can these outside actors use if our political, military, economic, social ties and exchanges are mutually benefit both our countries to such great extent?
Thank you. And then last question here, the woman in right there. Yes.
Hello. My question has to do with capacity constraints. I look particularly to Egypt, and I see that as they've built their government, they've faced a ton of capacity constraints with just not enough human capital to really truly govern properly. Is this a concern that you see as you look to the Gulf? Could this be a reason that maybe small, slight reforms would be better than just a drastic move to democracy?
Okay, the audience has shamed us into realizing that we have neglected the economy. So who would like to speak to that? Abdul Hadi?
Yes. Let me, the economy, because of several factors, because of, again, ruling families, wastage and incompetence in managing the economy resulted in a situation like that we have now. Bahrain, for example, was a visit by IMF group, and they told the Bahraini government that you have $11.8 billion in public debts. $3 billion of these are due to be paid this year. So this is a tiny Bahrain. Where these debts have come from? These debts have come from spending on security, spending on mega publicity projects, buying public relation firms, and The biggest of them is the Queen of England. Recently, she agreed to lend the King of Bahrain Windsor Park in order that he organize an annual race there. So this type of wastage led to what? To a situation that I, as an activist, I, as a social scientist, find it interesting. It ended up that the government has during the past 1 year, told everyone, all its loyals, that we will increase your salaries. 15%, some said 37%. Suddenly now, they decided now, zero increases. So the government cannot even now buy the support that we were complaining that they were buying. So the economy is in a mess, but it is not a mess because of the incomes. Saudi Arabia produces 10 million barrels per day. $100 per barrel, count it. This is 1 billion a day. So this is a lot of money. But it is so many princes, so many princesses, and so many join in eating that cake. Very limited part of the cake is left for this young graduate from a school. So you have this from 19 to 25, something like 23% unemployment in Saudi Arabia, according to recent figures in Saudi.
I think if I can address just the question of...
This is a ticking bomb, of course, but these are not the ones who will make the revolution. These are the ones who are probably will be recruited by religious fanatics in order for crusades here and there.
The problem with unemployment is that the educational literacy was spread to the whole population. Building a first-class quality educational system takes a lot of time. You have to educate the educators. You have to agree on a curriculum. The religious establishment played a big role in the curriculum. So it is recognized that the educational system has not produced the quality of students that the economy requires. At the same time, the last 30 years of excessive growth, the governments opened up the door, as Abdelhadi was saying, to bring in foreign labor. And so there's a big cost difference between the cheap foreign labor and more expensive domestic labor. This is a huge problem. The government is trying to address it, and they realize it's a huge problem. Just another question on the lady who mentioned capacity constraints. You're absolutely right. Capacity constraints are a huge problem. A very big problem, actually. And people underestimate that because they come to the Gulf and they see these great buildings. You walk into a ministry and it looks cutting edge, but you don't realize really that you know, you might have a bright minister, but the people around him, the people below him, he doesn't have the depth of the bench depth that even an Indian or a Pakistani or a Malaysian minister would have. So that is a very important point.
Ali, you come out of investment banking. Is there any pressure from within the banking community or in the private sector for these kinds of changes, or is this coming from the top
down? What sort of changes?
Changes in the labor market, changes in transparency.
No, look, the business community has a lot of complaints. Obviously, the Saudi market's very centralized, very bureaucratic, as is the Gulf market, by the way. I mean, trying to do business in the Emirates or Saudi Arabia or many of the Gulf countries, it's a very bureaucratic environment. So there are a lot of issues that are being raised. And, you know, there are capacity issues about prioritizing and dealing with them. Obviously, with the amount of money coming from oil, particularly the boom days of the past, 5 years, it has helped soften the impact.
Last word to Andrew, and then lunch.
In Bahrain, unemployment, I think it's this kind of vicious circle where to counter the protest movement and the opposition, the government has brought in more people to work in the health sector for a start, because a lot of the health sector was run by people who were, many of the doctors who were on trial and are in jail. There's been a kind of a purging of many opposition people, and frankly Shia, simply because they're Shia, within the health sector, so they bring in more people from outside. I heard recently that Egyptian electricians were being brought in to work in that sector. So you find that more Bahrainis are not getting jobs, which leads more to want to go on the streets. What is interesting, as the questioner hinted at was or said, was that it is interesting that, say, in Saudi Arabia, when you do have this big problem of unemployment, that it hasn't led to people to do more, you know, considering how bad it is. That might be because, I don't know why, but it could be because the country is so large and disparate that you have different people in different places. It's, in a way, it's kind of hard to organize in Saudi Arabia. Opposition figures like the guy who's in jail, Saud Mukhtar al-Hashimi, he's from Jeddah. You have others in Riyadh. Sometimes they haven't even heard of each other. You know, the regime has been so successful in keeping people apart. And just on the point of unemployment, I think that might work as well. In the Emirates, unemployment is an issue. Just recently, I saw a film made by an Emirati where it was just a succession of Emiratis complaining on screen about their travails trying to find work in the private sector and not being able to find it. It's a real problem. Especially in the northern Emirates, and that's where many of the people who've been on trial are actually from. And in the past, there's been concerns about the northern Emirates as well about various forms of Islamist politics being popular there. And one of the 9/11 bombers, one of the 19, was actually from one of the northern Emirates. And they've focused on the northern Emirates as a place where they have to develop more because they realize there's a problem with that.
Which brings us right back to Sarah's opening question about the intimate relationships between political and economic reform and the difficulty of separating those two. I would like to thank the panel for a stimulating and exciting panel. Thank you all.